Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by the publisher of The Bulwark, Sarah Longwell, who is live in studio, and the executive editor of The Bulwark, JVL, who is somewhere in a remote, non-disclosed location.
Yeah, great to see your face, Charlie.
I'm just recovering from Game 6.
Hey, man, what a game.
Pretty awesome. There's nothing better than Game 7s, even if it breaks your heart.
It's not going to break our heart, right, JVL? JVL and I text the whole way through the games.
I believe that we now have definitive proof that they're a team of destiny.
I don't know about that.
Do you guys not agree?
Well, people will be listening to this tomorrow, and so they'll know. So I wouldn't go too far out on a limb. Just caution you there.
I would just say this one thing that seems remarkable to me, which is that neither of the teams, both of whom have won three games at this point, have won those games on their home turf, which just seems strange,
yeah.
Right?
It has never happened before.
And I hope that stays true.
In Major League Baseball, the National Basketball Association and the National Hockey League, the three major sports with seven game championship series, no series has ever had six road wins.
Well, then that may be something you guys can talk about if it doesn't go your way. You know, you'll have something. Hey, listen, I want to brag a little bit about the podcast. I want to thank people for tuning in and listening. That we're not done with October, but October is already our most downloaded month since we began back in January. So I really appreciate that. I appreciate all the work of the guests and the producers and the listeners for making this podcast what it has become. So again, congratulations to us, I guess.
And congratulations to you. That's a real testament to you, Charlie.
We can brag on all of this. So apparently I gave some people some heart attacks this morning. I ran into one of our colleagues, Ben, who said, "You really scared the crap out of me," when he opened up the Bulwark and saw "In Praise of Sean Duffy." My old friend Sean Duffy from Wisconsin. But I have to clarify, this is just "In Praise of Sean Duffy," sort of, because completely inadvertently and unintentionally, what Duffy did was to show at least there are some limits to Trumpian indecency, at least temporarily. So for that, I suppose, for basically making himself the latest specimen of Trumpian roadkill, I guess, you know, he deserves the thanks of a grateful nation. So
there are some limits for some people.
For some people.
I mean, Laura Ingraham, John Yoo, who is today trying to somewhat walk back his statements. But it is good that people like Liz Cheney and others stood up to stand up for Vinogrand and his wealth of experience, his patriotism against what was a totally unconscionable smear from some corners of the right.
Yeah, and then the whole dual loyalty thing. But, you know, it is, and JVL, you've written about it, it's become this, it is reflexive. It's not even, you know, thought through that anyone who shows the slightest disloyalty to Donald Trump must be attacked, must be smeared, and the entire ethos of Trump world was sort of behind Sean Duffy until he stepped on his you-know-what.
Yeah, it's really something, isn't it? I mean, this is what the personality cults look like, right?
And well,
I am not convinced that... So Sean Duffy is... You said this in your piece. Sean Duffy has showed us where the line is as of yesterday.
As of yesterday, that's exactly
but
right.
But by Monday, the line will have moved. Right? Yeah, the lesson has always been from beginning with John McCain and the "I like my soldiers who weren't captured, right, or my war heroes who weren't captured," which people pushed back on. And then, you know, like 2 weeks later, people were making excuses for it. And then 2 months later, everybody who was a good standing Republican who was Trumpy had to officially hate John McCain, who had been the Republican nominee.
And still do. The Kahn family. You see what they're doing with William Taylor. You see what they're doing with... You saw what they did to Bob Mueller. Remember, we all sat around and thought, well, the thing about Mueller is there's no way you're going to be able to smear this guy. I mean, this is Mr. America, right? This is Captain America. He's a decorated Vietnam veteran, you know, universally respected. There's no way they're going to take this guy out. But again, prime directive of Trump world is you must be destroyed. So it's going to be hard. Now, I actually thought that I knew Sean Duffy the longest of any of us because we go back into Wisconsin. And as I point out in the piece, look, Sean Duffy's never been the brightest guy. I mean, you look, start off with the analysis here that Sean Duffy is just not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Always been kind of overshadowed by his wife, who I knew much better, Rachel Campos Duffy. But he had a long career ahead of himself as a mediocre congressman, but he decided to go full Trump, which I suppose if your major accomplishment in life was to be a reality TV star whose highlight of his entire career was the YouTube video of him dancing naked, this is you know, perhaps an inevitable career move. But you say you were familiar with him. You go way back with him.
Well, this is Sarah. This is the great shame of my life is that I am like a totally devoted, longtime watcher of The Real World. So not only that, but I have known normally you don't know who like a backbench congressman from Wisconsin is. But if you're me, you've been following his career because since I was 14 and The Real World San Francisco aired, which is actually the third season of The Real World, but the first one I was old enough to be allowed to watch, I have known of Rachel Campos Duffy. Campos,
yeah.
Who is a Republican on the show. She totally ingrained herself in my psyche because I was this sort of young, budding conservative, and I was so interested because back then the show wasn't garbage the way it is now. I know that it is garbage now because I still watch it.
What?
I am pushing 40 here, and the problem is they just make new seasons all the time, and so the thread has gone on continuously, and I've never lost it. But so, I remember when she kissed Puck in that third season, and that was the season where Pedro had AIDS, and you learned all about that, and she talked about her conservatism, and then you see her meet him, Sean, on, a challenge episode.
12 kids ago.
Yeah, and now they have 9 children together. So I have shamefully followed their career, but it is interesting to me in the sort of sad way that is a commentary on our culture today that the reality star that is now our president has one of the most shameful supporters in a reality show guy who is now a congressman and his wife, who is now a host of Fox News. And she, I know you know her, and I'd be interested in your opinion on her evolution because she is like an incredible suck up to Trump on the weekend. I mean, I've seen her say things like, God, he's just so fit and so virile. You know, like she talks about him in this insane way. Why is that?
This breaks my heart because
you know her.
Well, no, I mean, I knew both of them. And, you know, Sean Duffy was for a while kind of a protege of Paul Ryan. And Paul Ryan was really pushing him and, you know, wanted me to have him on the show all the time. And I would go back and forth with him saying, this guy's not ready for prime time. He's not very bright. He's not very good. On the other hand, Rachel Campos is fantastic. And she was poised to be the most prominent Hispanic conservative Republican in the country. She was, you know, working for something called the Libre Initiative, which was funded by the Koch brothers. She was articulate. She was feisty. She's attractive. And she was on that track. And then Trump came along and she and Sean just went totally into the tank. And it's just kind of amazing. So my paper trail with her goes way back. I used to edit a magazine, public policy magazine. We put her on the cover once. I used to run a thing called the Right Women Awards, where we'd have these big award ceremonies for rising conservative women. I gave her a big award. So I go way back with her. So it is mind-boggling to watch the degree to which Trumpism corrupts folks like that. So whatever. So there we have it. I've never watched The Real World. JVL, were you a Real World fan?
You know, I did not have cable TV growing up, but funnily enough, I did see a little bit of the third season of The Real World I saw a little bit of the third season of The Real World, and I remember it because this was the Puck, Pedro, and Rachel, was the super hot girl who was conservative, and Puck got thrown out of the house, and it was like, wow.
And she kissed Puck, which is what I always think about when I see her sucking up to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Because Puck was disgusting.
I was going to ask you, were you, so Puck was one of the first reality show heels.
Yeah, where they made him a bad guy, like a villain, totally.
Like he was made to be an actual villain on the show. And in many ways, Donald Trump is the Puck of Real World America edition.
Oh, well, all right. So, I mean, there's a segue.
There's a master's thesis.
Okay, speaking of other reality TV moments that we live in this alternative reality. So is Tulsi Gabbard going to run as a spoiler, third-party spoiler? She's got that op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, which sure sounds like she's setting herself up to go third-party, which would help Trump. And, I, you know,
I think maybe. I mean, I'm just going to.
I'm not calling her an asset. I'm not saying that.
I know I said. No. And I wouldn't say that in particular, because I think that Tulsi Gabbard is mostly in it for Tulsi Gabbard. But she is an incredibly peculiar politician. And I think that if she doesn't end up as Donald Trump's running mate and replace Mike Pence, which is a JVL theory, that it's very likely she ends up as a third party spoiler. And the reason is that you can say, well, look, she's getting propped up by a lot of Russian bots, which is entirely true. When we did a piece on her on the Bulwark, it like rocketed, which meant, I mean, and I'm sure lots of people were reading it, but it was sort of like a disproportionate, strange.
Somebody was pushing it out there.
Yeah. But the other thing is that there's an actual concerted effort among the right to push her. And it seems that somewhere in the background, there is potentially something going on where she could be a third party spoiler. They know what Jill
Federalist giving her campaign money.
Yeah. They know. Right? They know the what Wall Jill Stein Journal did for them the first time around.
Yeah. Right. The Wall Street Journal saying, oh, yeah, we would like you to we'd like to give our op-ed page to you to explain your vision for America, because that is what the readers of The Wall Street Journal want to read.
Right. Like a fourth tier Democratic candidate from who's a, you know, congresswoman from Hawaii.
Just the whole story is bizarre, and it's going to get more bizarre. OK, so speaking of The Wall Street Journal, we have to have like a little moment of substance here before I get back into the insanity. And literally, I mean, I want to talk about insanity in just a couple of moments. GDP numbers came in showing that in the last quarter, the economy grew by 1.9%. And of course, the president puts out a tweet that, you know, the greatest economy in history. But of course, back in 2012, when the economy also grew at, wait for it, 1.9%. Trump put out a tweet. This is always a tweet saying how much the economy sucks. But the interesting thing about these numbers is that business investment is actually down by 3%. That appears to be, I think, the headline of the story, because wasn't that the kind of the whole point of Trumponomics and the tax cut, that it was going to encourage businesses to invest?
Yeah, I don't know, JVL, if you want to take this one or not, but I think that's right. And I think part of what's happening here is there was a kind of sugar high post tax cut that you are starting to see, you're starting to just see sort of dissipate. And if you look sector by sector, like if you dig in on some of like the real estate sector, it is starting to look an awful lot like it did in 2007. In terms of to just like, you know, when people materials, things like that, that people invest in, those types of things are down. And so, yeah, I think it portends something nasty. The question is whether or not whatever is coming comes fast enough to be laid at Donald Trump's feet, or will it be, assuming he loses, somebody else's problem?
Yeah. JVL?
Well, this was the one of the criticisms of the Trump tax cut from the right, was that you were goosing the economy and that you were giving businesses money to invest that they were unlikely to invest and they were likely instead to save. And in fact, that's what happened, right? I mean, we saw this immediately. It did not go into business spending so much as it went into corporations stuffing that money away. And this is, you know, it's so undeniable that the Drudge Report right now, this is the lead item. GDP, 1.9%. It's in red. They then run the Trump, you know, Trump on GDP, 1.9 GDP in 2012, quote, economy is in deep trouble, and they have a giant frowny emoji.
Drudge Report.
I mean, this is
not a frowny emoji.
A frowny emoji. Wow. So, I would say this sort of thing is undeniable.
I'm pausing here to load this up, because the Drudge Report's defection from Trumpism is an interesting story in and of itself.
Yeah,
do you know what the story is? I mean, it's clear that it's happening, but do you know why?
Do you think he's human scum?
Do you think he's a never Trumper secretly, Matt Drudge?
Of course he's human scum, and everyone's never Trumper who is not completely pro Trump, right? Haven't we discovered that anyone who shows any courage whatsoever is labeled a never Trumper? I tweeted out and I said, I'm by the way, I'm okay with that.
Same. Yeah. Also, after maybe a really bad year where I think our numbers in the never Trump coalition really shrank, we're sort of bulking back up with a bunch of sort of big names that I'm very proud to be associated with.
Okay, so I'm looking at the Drudge Report right now. You know what the top picture is right now? Is a picture of Richard Nixon getting on the helicopter. And it says, Specter of Nixon looming over Republican Party. Second item is Colonel testifies he raised concerns about Ukraine Trump. Third item, transcript gaps. Then third, fourth, a top diplomat willing to go public, whistleblower lawyers receive death threats, Schumer worried Trump will force shutdown to impede impeachment. And then, of course, it has this, and boy, the symbolism of this, the Reagan Library fire danger, that fire is creeping very close to the Reagan Library. So, I mean, you know, metaphor alert. And there it is. There's your sort of unhappy emoji look. GDP 1.9%, China trolls, Fed. Whew, yeah. This is interesting.
There is.
And by the way, here's another headline. Trump assumes Obama's mantle as the king of debt.
Yeah. So this is the real problem for Trump. There is no prospective good news on the horizon for him anytime in the foreseeable future. It is not the case where you can say, oh, well, we'll just sit back and wait and the good economic news will keep coming in. It isn't going to keep coming in. Now, maybe there won't be bad economic news. Maybe it'll all be stuff like the stagnating growth and things slowing down, but it's not going to be good anymore. There is clearly no good news on the impeachment front, because we have now gotten enough corroboration to, I think, reasonably believe that the story is roughly what everybody thinks it was, which means that the debate shifts to, well, was it impeachable or not? So there's no good news coming from that either. We're not going to get good news in the Middle East. We're not going to get good news from China or Russia because the president is weak and they have no incentive to help. Right. So this is, if you're a Republican and you look at the numbers right now, and you've got a guy who is minus 12 or minus 13 overall, job approved, disapprove, and the impeachment numbers are now like plus 13, plus 14, and are likely to go higher, that's like a 25, 30 point spread between his job approval and support for impeachment and removal. Like, how do you think you are going to go before voters 12 months from now and make the case that, like, hey, send us back? Like, how? I just don't know how the Republicans can, in their heart of hearts, believe that this is a case they can make and be successful.
Okay, so Thursday, the House is finally going to have this vote, the quote-unquote formal vote, to authorize the impeachment proceedings, the one the Republicans have been asking for forever and complaining about forever, and now, of course, are going to be completely dissatisfied with. Does that fundamentally change the situation, JVL?
No. What I've been arguing all along is that, so the Republicans are only arguing process because they realize it's the only place they can argue. They have no substantive arguments to make. And the problem with the process arguments, I mean, just as a tactical matter, is that the arguments they were advancing were all going to be invalidated eventually. So they weren't even making process arguments that could, you know, sustain over the course of months. They knew that the Democrats would eventually go and call the bluff because they had to, right? At some point, there's going to be a vote. At some point, the hearings will be opened up. And at that point, their bad faith will be further exposed, right? Because all of a sudden, if you've been saying, why won't you open up, then you have to shift to, well, now it's too late. And again, you don't need to convince everybody. If 10% more independents look at this stuff and say, yeah, this is bad, the Republicans are really bad, that's enough to swing us to all of a sudden like 60% improve a favor of impeachment. You know, like, this is, people look at these things and they say, oh, well, you're not going to convince everybody, you know, some giant percentage of Republicans are going to hang tough. Well, sure, but if only 70% of Republican voters hang tough on this, it's a disaster for Republican office holders, right? I mean, this is, yeah. You got to understand all the action is at the margins.
And as you point out, everything gets worse now with impeachment. With this vote now, it now becomes public. At some point, the trial or the hearings will be televised, which changes the dynamic. There will be more evidence that comes out. And what's fascinating is that all of these folks are defying the White House, attempting to block them. These are all Trump's own people. I mean, these are all the calls from within the House. So there's more stuff coming out. There may be more smoking guns. And I think if you follow Donald Trump in the past, when the pressure gets on, he may behave even more erratically and bizarrely. So Republican senators really have to kind of strap in here, because there's no aspect of this that gets any better. I assume he's going to be acquitted at the end of this, but I also think that the one, and I've said this before on this podcast, this is the one factor that I think is going to be overwhelming in 2020 is just exhaustion. is that people are, you go through all of this, and then Republicans are going to try to make the case, 4 more years. We have 4 more years of this.
Yeah, let me just push back on your guys' scenario, even though I'd love to believe that that's where we actually end up. But there's a couple of things here. One, with the there's going to be this vote, and I actually think you are more likely to get an up or down vote on yes for impeachment among many of these House members than you are for the impeachment inquiry.
Mm, okay, and some that seems of it, counterintuitive.
So some of it comes down, right, it seems safer to vote for the inquiry, but some of it comes down to timing, right? So they want to wait as long as possible because many of them are looking at filing deadlines for primary challengers. Mm-hmm. So that's part of it, which is why so much of the focus is on people who are...
You're talking about Republicans.
Talking about Republicans. Okay, I'm saying like especially among Republicans. So right now, for this not to be an entirely partisan exercise, you've got to pick up a handful of Republicans. And I think there are a handful of Republicans to be gotten in the House that will vote
but
for
not
impeachment.
Thursday.
But I think the inquiry, right... They've got to contend with the fact that they do think there are these like process problems that they're upset about. And it wouldn't surprise me if you saw a guy like Will Hurd maybe vote against the actual inquiry, but maybe go for impeachment. Now, that's speculation, but I just think that's a weird thing that could be at play. And the other thing that I think can happen is, all right, so a handful of Republicans in the House vote to impeach him. They get, let's say, 3 Republican senators to go for it. Let's say Murkowski, Romney, I don't know, and Lamar Alexander. So they vote to impeach. So then he claims exoneration. It's February, getting on March, and Elizabeth Warren is surging. And Elizabeth Warren becomes the Democratic nominee, and Trump gets handed the biggest gift of his presidency, because I was just doing focus groups in central Pennsylvania, and with a whole bunch of people who think that Trump is loathsome. Trump voters who are tired of him, think he's narcissistic, think he's wrong, thinks he's a bad person, don't want their kids to be like him. They throw every criticism at him. And at the end of the day, when you say, show of hands, 2020, Elizabeth Warren's the nominee, who do you vote for? Maybe they pick up one of the women. Maybe she picks up one of the women. It's just, it is... This is going to come down to an incredibly tight decision where people feel genuinely conflicted by, you know, he's going to say socialist, 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 Pocahontas, 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 and it's going to get real tight, real fast. Impeachment will be behind him. He will have been exonerated. That is a scenario that I would put out there that is potentially.
Well, we have to push back on the fact that it's not an exoneration. I mean, if he's found not guilty. I think what's going to be interesting is what is the vote? Is it possible to get to a majority of the Senate, which will be an historic taint? Is it possible that you will, I mean, are Republicans who vote to acquit also going to stand up and say that his behavior was totally inappropriate? Because, part of that's going to be framing it.
Yeah. And I think some of them, that's like their talking point now, right? They are getting in position to get in position to make this vote. And that is when you say, yeah, this wasn't right. You should not do this. Wrap this guy on the knuckles. But, you know, he's an unconventional politician. He really doesn't, understand. And there's like this, you know, four-dimensional chess that he's playing. You know, you guys can't really understand his process. And so he won't do it again.
Will that change, though, when you start to actually see the televised testimony of people like, you know, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Ambassador Taylor, when other members of the National Security Staff, John Bolton testifies?
You know, maybe.
Because as JVL says, you only need to move a few percentage points to really change the political dynamic.
Oh, and I completely agree with JVL about that. And I think that where you're going to see a lot of big numbers break is among independents. And you can potentially get to 60% for a period of time. The question is, will those numbers hold? And will they hold when you have an actual counterweight that people feel very uneasy about on the other side as well? I want to be on your guys' side. I'm just saying that I can see this alternate scenario.
I can see it as well. I think it is interesting, though, you know, hearing the complaints from Republicans that, that they're waiting for their talking points, and, you know, how embarrassing it is that they are forced to defend the president. And like, guys, you're actually not forced to defend the president.
And yet they do. And I'll tell you something else that was interesting in the focus groups is that these guys were thought that like the Democrats were going to get Trump one way or the other, you know, so they don't see what he did as like. A huge deal. But one of the questions that we asked was whether or not you would think better or worse of your Republican congressman if they voted for impeachment or if they spoke out about the fact that it was wrong. And the vast majority said they would feel better about them.
Really?
Not that they would hold it against them. There were some that said they wanted blind loyalty, but mostly people were like, actually, it's about time for somebody to grow some balls, as a direct quote.
Okay. So I want to switch. This is related, but I want to switch to actual insanity because I'm slightly obsessed about this. I'm obsessed with the number of people who I think demonstrably have lost their minds in all of this. And I'm going to put you on the spot here, JBL, okay?
Okay.
Because Fox Business yesterday, you know where I'm going on this? Fox Business has a guest, one of your former colleagues, Lee Smith, who's out with a big best-selling book now. And this is what he said. He said, here is how I see what we're calling the impeachment process inquiry. I see it as a secret ritual conducted by a cult. And I think it's worthwhile thinking of Speaker Pelosi as the high priestess of the cult and Adam Schiff as a high priest of the cult. Okay, so an alternative of explanation would be that the impeachment process is a constitutionally mandated form of congressional accountability. But here you have Lee Smith out there who is referring to the impeachment process as a ritual conducted by a cult. What?
I would say this. Lee and I have differing views on Donald Trump and the direction of the Republican Party, but my general rule is I just won't ever cap on my friends, and Lee was never anything but a buddy to me, and I hope he makes $5 million from this book.
See, this is the advantage that I have of being an only child and having no friends, because I can do this. This is nuts. This is insane. This is the kind of thing where, you know, it is, I think, possible to come up with rationalizations for Trumpism, and then you get the people who just go way past the Kool-Aid. I mean, it's like they're setting the Kool-Aid on fire, and they're drinking it, and they're bathing in it, and they're doing all of this stuff. Okay, so speaking of insanity, this will be easier for you guys. Lou Dobbs. I won't play the whole thing here. Lou Dobbs is on with Donald Trump Jr. You see what he says here? He says, the great thing about Donald Trump is that Donald Trump never talks about himself. Instead, quote, President Trump is truly the president of we. Now, Ian Bassin, who we all know, tweeted this out and he said, psychologists will need to study this era of America if we survive it. The ability of the human brain to defy human senses to this degree will need some new label. It's like Trumposis or something, the phenomenon of the brain perceiving facts in the world as their opposite. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, wait, so who said that, Dom Jr. or Lou Dobbs?
Lou Dobbs says that Trump never talks about himself. He is truly the president of we.
Because I saw Don Jr. On Fox talking about Hunter Biden and saying how unbelievably unfair it was for a young man like Hunter Biden to be trading off of his father's political celebrity. And it is like what happens is to me, it is there is a clear group of people where I saw Stephanie, the Grisham, who is the spokesperson, said that John Kelly was a bad chief of staff because he couldn't appreciate Trump's genius. Like, what
the genius of our brilliant president.
The genius of our brilliant president, which is insane North Korea type language. But to me, it has been, I had not realized that shame was such a virtue, like how necessary it is for a functioning society is to have the sense of shame. And if you remove it from people and they just have no shame and they can talk like Lou Dobbs or like Don Jr. or these people, then this is what you get.
Yeah, but it's beyond that. So, JVL, isn't this almost like the Jedi mind trick or something? I mean, we need a new category for it. It's like, yeah, Don Jr. saying, yes, the thing about Hunter Biden that we ought to really is he's trading on his father's name. Are you kidding? Is he just simply saying that so that our heads will explode, so that we are in fact triggered, which is the name of his probably unreadable new book? I mean, what?
No, he's saying it because for 35% of the general public, they believe it. And this is honestly, I forget who wrote this. It was probably somebody I hate. But somebody wrote a long time ago that for Trump, shamelessness, the degree to which he possesses it actually makes it into a superpower.
Well, I think that's true.
And I think that's right. I actually think it gives him an asymmetrical advantage over normal human beings.
Right. Look at
Katie
Hill.
Would you disagree?
Look at what happened with Katie Hill. You know, Katie Hill had this, you know, she had an inappropriate relationship with a staffer. She had an angry husband who released, you know, intimate pictures of her. And, like, she resigns. Now, whether Nancy Pelosi went or not, but, like, that is the thing that a normal person just can't withstand the shame of. Donald Trump has had 13 women graphically recount sexual assaults and rapes by him. And has just been like, yeah, she's not hot enough for that to be true. Like, not my type.
And he's still the president.
And so that is how he is weaponized and ran it into a superpower.
I have been, taking some pride in the fact that I have not commented at all on the Katie Hill story whatsoever.
Same.
Now. Because I just wanted to recuse myself from the whole thing, and I just don't want the hot takes on all of this.
Nobody comes out great in that story.
Nobody comes out great. She's not a victim because she did have a sexual relationship with somebody who was working for her, which violates house rules. But you have to feel a little bit sympathetic to her because, this is revenge porn that's been weaponized by political opponents who want to smear her.
Yeah, who got together with her ex-husband who had, it's all so gross.
It is gross. And
I feel bad for her. I mean, I think what she did was wrong and I think it's okay that she resigned. But I still feel very bad that.
Should she have resigned, JVL? And because, by the way, I'm thinking of one of your prescient pieces when you pointed out the game theory that would dictate that Virginia Governor Ralph Northam should not resign after the blackface incident, and you wrote that at the time when every single person in the world thought that he was dead man walking, and of course he's still the governor of Virginia. So should she have resigned even when the naked pictures came out and the picture of her smoking the bong and all that stuff?
So I intentionally didn't follow any of the Katie Hill story because I just didn't want it in my brain.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm there.
It all seemed gross. But I would echo what Sarah just said. People do have to realize that there is... I know often people... One of the cliches is that, you have to realize politicians are people too.
Yeah.
Most of them aren't. Like, most of them are... Most of them are like bizarre, emotionally stunted weirdos, right? And because you have to be in order to spend large parts of your living walking in front of total strangers and first asking them for money and then asking them to love you. You're not just not normal. Normal people couldn't do that, and normal people would not do that. And it does strike me this is the case where a normal human being, a normal, like, reasonably healthy, high-functioning person confronted with a situation like that would say, you know what, I will go work in another industry. You know, this is not...
I'm not sure what industry
this is not be, worth the price of this. I can go be a real estate agent or go work for, Intertrobe, filing TPS reports or something.
Well, so is this a good time for me to announce that I'm planning to run for the Pennsylvania Congressional District?
Well, the best part about the story, of course, is that that George Papadopoulos, who went to jail for lying to the FBI, says he's running for Katie Hill's seat and appeared to have had some kind of a heads up on some of the stuff that was coming out. I mean, you didn't think that the writers were going to bring George Papadopoulos back here in season three, did you?
Season three sucks, man. It sucks.
Okay, is anybody here a Game of Thrones fan? I forget.
We've talked about this.
Okay, so I'm
JVL doesn't watch it, but I do.
I don't understand that, JVL. I just don't get it.
I'm into it. Look, it is not. It is simply a function of time.
Okay. Oh, no,
I am in theory 100% into Game of Thrones. I'm a huge Cersei Lannister fan, just from her gifts.
Oh, yeah. So here's the thing. I'm a little obsessed with these stories that have come out in the last 48 hours. The first story says that HBO had killed one of the prequels. They had had a prequel from like the Age of Heroes or something, and this was killed. And apparently, it was all shot, and they were in post-production, and they killed the whole thing, which is like, what? And then today, because apparently this caused ripples of grief and horror and disappointment, they've announced that they have greenlit they are greenlighting another prequel. So I don't know. Is anybody we got to sort this out. I'm going to spend disproportionate amount of time. I just have to warn you guys, trying to figure out what is going on here. But
I saw there was a prequel. What, JVL?
So we got to shut HBO down until we figure out what the hell is going on.
Yes.
The news I saw today was that they have signed on to do a 10-episode prequel, which is around the Targaryen family. Yeah. House of Dragons, I believe, is what it is called.
I'm okay with that.
Sounds awesome.
No, okay.
But did they kill something they had already shot?
Yes, there was another one. Naomi Watts had apparently been starring in it. And
it must be bad. I mean, they killed it, and Naomi Watts is starring in it, and it was the most profitable thing that HBO had done in
a decade. How bad could it be? It's like coining money. You could put up cat videos, and say it's the prequel, and you'd make tons of money, right? No, or am I wrong?
I don't know. I mean, what if you destroy the franchise in the press? I don't know. I have no idea what's going on with it. But I mean, clearly you don't kill something like that for that very reason unless there's
I'm sorry. I'm efforting this right now. and it does not look like it. She had been cast, and they were in pre-production. Oh, in
Actual all right, because that did kind of rattle me.
This one, so this prequel, the Naomi Watts prequel, was set thousands of years prior to Game of Thrones, whereas the new one is set only about 300 years prior to Game of Thrones. How is it I know more about the show that I don't watch than either of you?
Because you're Googling it right now. that's like a trick question or something. It's like, because you're sitting there Googling Game of Thrones prequel.
As long as we get Cersei Lannister walking around saying that she chooses violence, that's all I care about.
No.
Are you guys, here's my big question. It's because you guys are Game of Thrones people. Give me a greater sign, lesser sign. Cersei or Daenerys?
Now, what are we, we're just greater or lesser?
Greater or lesser.
As pick a character one. Or as like a moral human in terms of like totaling up their body count?
That's the question. I'm not going to define it for you.
This is like the old Gilligan's Island thing, right? You know, Marianne or Ginger or Marianne, is that what you're asking?
Here's the thing. I'm gonna go greater than Cersei Lannister wins for me, primarily because, and it has to do with the writing of the show, she was consistent in her evilness for the entire time, whereas Daenerys was the inevitable hero of the show who makes an insane, like, last season, sorry, spoiler alert, personality like transplant switch type thing to become an entirely different person at the end.
Yeah, but I'm gonna go the opposite direction. Okay. I think you got to go with Daenerys because she had freaking dragons. When she walks naked out of that place and it's burning.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You know, when she burns all the horse people. What were they called? I'm sorry. I'm having a moment.
The horse people.
Yeah, I'm gonna make a joke that neither of you is gonna get. The Rohirrim?
No. Oh,
our nerd listeners are driving off the side of the road right now.
I didn't get it.
It's a Lord of the Rings thing. The horse people in Lord of the Rings were the horse masters of the Rohirrim.
I actually should have known that, and people are wondering what is happening. What is happening to this podcast?
Yeah, we've really gone off the rails.
Well, no, I mean, in part because we all have to find coping mechanisms to get through the next 6 months. Not to mention the next year.
The World Series is the emotional roller coaster we all need.
Yeah, but you know what tomorrow is? It's the first day without baseball, so you're gonna have to start coping with that too, one way or another. It's over.
You're such a downer, Charlie.
It is done for you people. It's like, okay, you've left the Magic Kingdom and you have to come back now. So we have to have something else to get us through this.
Impeachment, baby.
And it's going to be, well, you know what? You know that we're going to sit there and we're going to be watching all of this and we're all going to be comparing it. Like, you know, where were you during Haldeman and Ehrlichman? Don't answer. Come on. I just, you know, but I mean, that was
a zygote.
You were a zygote?
I don't know, actually. I don't actually know enough about science to know whether that is a... I think I probably wasn't that thing at all.
In 1974. So, I mean, it was...
I was 6 years from a zygote.
Okay, it was... Okay, so you were minus... You were minus six zygotes.
T-6.
Okay, take my word for it. It was a BFD. It was really a big deal. And those things can change public opinion. And again, it doesn't have to huge swings, but there's going to be some drama. And I think the significance of yesterday with the Vindman stuff was it was kind of like a high hard one, a brushback pitch, since you guys are into the baseball stuff, to Republicans who think that if they keep using the same playbook of just smearing anybody that comes out against Trump, you know, reflexively defending anything that Trump comes up with, it might just blow up in their face. So there might be a little bit more caution. I mean, you know that they're going to want to go after, you know, Colonel Vindman. But I think your good buddy Sean Duffy has made that a lot harder now. So there's going to be that moment where he shows up and he's going to wear the uniform with all the medals and all the stuff there. And that's going to be a moment of high drama.
Well, won't that create some tension, though, Charlie? Because Trump won't stop. Right.
Exactly.
As long as he has two thumbs. Every time somebody like that is in public, he's going to be on Twitter talking about how they are deep state traitors and they ought to be shot and they're human scum and blah, blah, blah. And so at some point, I would imagine, and honestly, this may be the big danger for Republicans, is not that they'll desert Trump, but that Trump will desert them because they aren't sufficiently defending him.
Oh, I think there's already signs of that.
And this was... this could be a real thing where if they're not willing, you know, they'll say, hey, we'll vote for you, but we're not going to like blow ourselves up and light ourselves on fire. And
he wants them to light themselves on fire.
And they won't do that. And it really could be a place where, you know, they want to hang with him, but he forces them not to.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he's out there whip counting people. Did you see that crazy photograph of Trump with Shimkus and McCarthy? And there's one other person who's in there, I think, at probably Trump Hotel, having like some kind of bacon on a wire of some kind, some fancy dinner.
Frog
but legs. Shimkus has gone from saying, I won't support the president in 2020, I'm retiring, to here's a photo op and I'm rethinking whether or not I'm retiring. So there's an active there's an active campaign to hold people in line.
But the point I think JVL is making, though, is that when he demands absolute, total, 100% fealty, even Lindsey Graham falls short, apparently, of that ideal. And so the whole resolution, the Graham resolution condemning the House procedures with blah, 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 was as a result of the fact that Trump and Trump world were beating up on Lindsey Graham for not being enthusiastic enough. I mean, these guys would love to be the inappropriate but not impeachable. But I think what Trump is going to do is demand, no, you must say it was completely perfect. You can't say it is inappropriate. Otherwise, you're a leftist, never Trump scum type person. And there may be some people go, well, screw it. I can't go that far. Now,
I've been arguing that that's true. Like, I think that the more Republicans are going to do the right thing than people think. I don't know how many times somebody's going to have to hit me over the head with a brick before I say, like, I'm not positive these guys will do the right thing. I'm watching weird things happen.
Look, I'm not positive either. I should say this is I'm looking at one of the three or four possible futures here and saying that I think it is more like I think it is undervalued as a betting proposition right now. That's all.
What is undervalued? Is a betting proposition.
The possibility that Republicans have to turn on him.
Well, how many Republicans would turn on him?
Enough to remove him from office.
Oh, so you're going all the way to 20.
Well, I would say of the, if we say we have four possible scenarios right now and we're looking to see which of those stocks is most undervalued, I think impeach and remove is the most undervalued publicly.
Oh, okay. So I think the World Series has gotten to you, JVL. Because you are always the darkest, most pessimistic voice on this podcast and in our pages, because you have persuasively argued in the past that we are living in the worst possible timeline, right?
JVL and I are 100% switched right now in what we're arguing.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm always the optimistic
one. And now
one.
JVL is like giddy with optimism, and it's like rainbows and unicorns are going to come out of Mitch McConnell's ass.
Like 3 hours last night. Okay. That could also be part of what's going on here. Maybe after the World Series is over and I get back to like my normal 6 hours of sleep a night, I will be
okay.
I'll go back to my normal pessimistic self.
But let me just agree with this, what JVL said just really quickly, which is the fact is, think about how insane everything is right now. Like, would you bet entirely against the fact that something entirely new comes out? I mean, well, clearly what's out now isn't enough to make everyone abandon him, right? They're chipping away at the numbers. People are learning what happened. There's going to be an offense campaign from them to say, yeah, he did it, but it wasn't that bad. But what are the odds that something else earth-shaking happens?
Okay, now I'm willing to go along with that, because you are starting to see all of these folks coming out willing to testify. These are extraordinary moments. So is there any reason to believe there won't be other smoking guns, more transcripts, or that somebody leaks the actual text of the transcript between Trump and Vladimir Putin? At that point, that would be shocking and stunning. Would it change reality? Who knows?
Well, just think. So today, the chances of him being being impeached, so the chances of articles of impeachment passing are probably what, north of 90%?
Oh, yeah.
Would you say?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
8 weeks ago,
98%.
The chance of articles of impeachment being passed against him probably would have been south of 10%.
Fair.
Right. I mean, these things can change, and again, the momentum is all moving the other way. I mean, there is. Just as a theoretical matter, there is some point at which popular opinion forces things to change, whether or not the individual actors want it to. Now, I don't know if that point is 65% in favor or 60% in favor or 58% in favor. But there is a theoretical point at which if the country is done and wants to be done, then it's going to happen.
We
may not make that.
Something
there, right?
Something needs to happen, some event. And by the way, we're taping this on Wednesday, early Wednesday afternoon. Doesn't the announcement about killing Baghdadi feel like it was like a year ago? It feels so long ago. It's possible that Donald Trump will get no bump whatsoever out of that. Which, think about that. You know, that not even probably the single best story he could have hoped for that he could have had can't move his numbers. Which again goes back to what happens if you get more bad news here. Hey, so we're out of time. Appreciate it very much, Sarah Longwell, JVL. Thank you for coming in. And I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.